try not to cough too much into the mic. Okay. So then with that kind of being said, we have to remember, you know, all the things we talked about there a couple weeks ago in regards to the creation through the Krebs cycle. So like glycolysis, none of the reactions of the Krebs cycle directly uses oxygen. This is an exclusive function of the electron transport chain. You saw oxygen as part of the carrier, right? And we have to remember, what is the chemical layout for water? H2O. H2 means what? Two molecules of hydrogen and one molecule of oxygen. So you saw that, well, when the person that was talking in the video, the animation was talking about how there were eight hydrogen molecules, four of which cross the barrier to go to the other side of the membrane, four of which each attached to one molecule of oxygen. So the byproduct of that transport of hydrogen resulted in two molecules of water, okay, as part of it. So this is where oxygen comes in. This oversees the final catabolic reactions that occur in the mitochondria. Because the reduced coenzyme produced during the Krebs cycle are the grist, or the substrates, of the electron transport chain, MIL, these pathways are coupled and both phases are considered to be oxygen requiring. So what the hell do I mean by grist and MIL? I know, I'm old. Did you guys not take like Pioneers back when you went to high school or elementary school? Yeah, did you talk about the Pioneers? Yeah, okay. So what's a grist and MIL? What's grist and MIL? You all eat bread, right? Yeah, how do you make flour? Yeah, so you have seeds, you have wheat seeds, and you used to have a stone, and the water would turn the gears, and the stone would grind those seeds into powder, which you now know as flour, right? So what we're saying here is that when we say the reduced coenzymes in the Krebs cycle are the grist, or the seed, the grain, of the electron transport chain mill that grinds them down, if you want to use that term. So the electron transport, or the Krebs cycle, creates the products, basically, that the electron transport chain utilizes to create ATP. It's exactly what I said before I started recording. Okay? So they're being made in the electron, or in the Krebs cycle, and then those products get utilized in the electron transport chain to therefore create the ATP. In other words, ATP is not created so much in the Krebs cycle, but in the electron transport chain. But because they're so connected, they're so coupled, they're considered to be all part of the same process to create ATP, because there's oxygen present, therefore we say it's aerobic metabolism. So the hydrogens removed during the oxidation of food fuels are now combined with oxygen, and the energy is released. The energy released is harnessed to attach to phosphate groups to ADP. So the fact that we're taking oxygen that we saw in the video there, and we're using oxygen to carry hydrogen across with a byproduct of water, because oxygen is there, we now call this oxidative phosphorylation. Because remember, 2 weeks ago, what did we have to do to the glucose molecule once it entered the cell? So that it wouldn't run away out of the cell. What do we have to add to it? Right, and that is known as? Correct. So we phosphorylated glucose when it entered the cell, and now because oxygen is utilized in this process, right, we're attaching phosphate groups to ADP, we're attaching a phosphate to ADP to make ATP, so we are phosphorylating it. And because we're doing it in the presence of oxygen, it's known as oxidative phosphorylation. Okay? Not really? It's Monday. I just got back. I've been on holidays for a week. So you can see it here. Some important things. I mean, we saw the video. We're going to see it again. But you can see here that we've got this NADH. We've got these hydrogen atoms. And you can see that the whole purpose of these three complexes, right, they're all about getting, using electrons as energy to allow hydrogen to pass through to the other side of the membrane. So this is a mitochondria. Up here is the outer membrane, that smooth shell of the mitochondria. And here we have the inner mitochondrial membrane. Of course, it's convoluted and right, creates what? The convolutions are called cristae, right? Remember that? Yes? Okay. And it is through these complexes that we get the pumping of hydrogen so that we have a greater amount of hydrogen outside this membrane than inside. So we have a concentration gradient, where we have more hydrogen outside than inside. And this is where we get the energy to bind the second and third phosphate molecules. Okay? So the electron transport chain involves a sequence of electron carrier molecules, and they're found, as I said, in the inner mitochondrial membrane. And they are capable of oxidation and reduction, okay? As the electrons pass through the chain, we get a release of energy, and that is that energy that we use to form ATP. Remember, we have an ADP that we had a phosphate 2 to make it ATP. The last electron acceptor is oxygen. So in that one bit in the animation you saw, that last complex utilized two oxygen molecules with eight hydrogens. Four of those hydrogens attached to the two oxygen molecules to create two water molecules, but the other four went to the other side to increase the gradient on the outside of the membrane. Yes? You saw that? Remember that? Okay. This mechanism of ATP generation links chemical reactions with a pumping process, therefore it's called chemiosmosis. So osmosis has things moving up or down the concentration gradient. Correct. Anytime it's up, it's active and you have to give it energy because you're going against the grain, right? In those complexes, do we use energy to pump hydrogen across the membrane because it's going up? If you know the answer to that, everything else will become easy. Let's go back here. Where's more oxygen, at the top or the bottom there? At the top, right? Remember, we have a membrane here. We'll just call it top and bottom. So up here is top. Down here is bottom. Are there more hydrogen atoms here than down here? Okay. So what does hydrogen want to do via the rules of osmosis? What direction does it want to move? It wants to move from up to down. Correct. Just simply because there's more hydrogen on that side than on the other side. So osmotically, hydrogen wants to move. So because you have greater hydrogen up here at the top, electrons provide energy for these complex pumps to pump hydrogen to create a concentration gradient of greater amounts of hydrogen on this side. When we get down here to what's called ATP synthase, this is a specialized complex that utilizes the law of osmosis to its advantage. It allows hydrogen in because hydrogen wants to move over here, right? So the only way it can get over here in its natural osmotic law, it gets caught up in ATP synthase, where ATP synthase would tell you, what does it do? It creates ATP. It synthesizes it, right? Okay? So you're creating a gradient by pumping against the gradient, right? Up the gradient to get hydrogen up here. And then you have a little molecule here that allows the normal movement of hydrogen to want to drop back in, and it utilizes that gradient difference and the charge to create that bond between the second and third. Everybody follow me so far? Any questions? Okay. So this is why it's called chemiosmosis. So number one, energy from NADH and hydrogen passes along the chain and is used to pump hydrogen from the matrix of the mitochondria into the space between the inner and outer membranes. Everybody follow where we are right now? Remember, the fluid within the convolutions of the inner membrane is called the matrix. Remember that? Okay. So we're saying that hydrogen, you're pumping hydrogen from the matrix to the space between the two membranes, right? Therefore, you end up with a high concentration of hydrogen accumulating between the inner and outer membranes of the mitochondria. Everybody followed that thus far? So through these pumps, you're getting a high concentration of hydrogen between the outer and inner membranes of the mitochondria. Okay? ATP synthesis then occurs as hydrogen diffuses back into the mitochondrial matrix through a special type of hydrogen channel in the inner membrane, which we saw as ATP synthase. Okay? But we're going to get to that in a moment. So we have hydrogen wanting to move back in. There are five carriers: flavin, mononucleotides, cytochromes, iron sulfur centers, copper, and ubiquinones. I'm not going to challenge you on those names. I just want you to understand that there are a number of carriers or electron carriers that through this electron carrying are bringing hydrogen molecules from one side of the membrane and pumping them out to the other. So the first step in the chain is the transfer of electrons from the NADHH to flavin mononucleotides. We have to remember that during glycolysis, where was glycolysis occurring? Outside the Krebs cycle, correct? Glycolysis, we had two NADH plus two Hs, so two NADH plus two hydrogens are generated, and two more from the formation of acetyl-CoA, and six from the Krebs cycle. So we have to see that we had these hydrogens that are created through all these processes. Two NADH and two hydrogen from glycolysis. When we form acetyl-CoA, we had two more, and then the Krebs cycle created six more hydrogens. In the second step, the new compound passes electrons to the next center and then to the next, which picks up additional hydrogen. So it's all about picking up hydrogen and pumping it from the low side to the high side. Does everybody follow that much? Okay? So it's all about pumping a greater amount of hydrogen to the outside of the inner membrane. Okay? Outside the matrix. Each carrier is reduced as it picks up electrons and oxidized as it loses electrons. The last carrier passes its electrons to one half of a molecule of oxygen, which then becomes negatively charged, which picks up two hydrogen molecules to form H2O. All you need to take from that is that oxygen comes in here and is utilized to get these eight hydrogen molecules into the complex, four of which bind to the oxygen molecules to create water, the other four of which pass through the complex to get to the other side. Okay? Within the inner mitochondrial membrane, the carriers of the electron transport chain cluster into three complexes, and they form what are called proton pumps. Now, what they do, they expel hydrogen, which puts it out into the space between the inner and outer membranes, increasing the concentration of hydrogen in that space between the inner and outer membranes. We have further electron carriers when that happens. One electron carrier ferries electrons from the first to the second complex, and the second carrier carries the electrons from the second to the third. So if we look back here, what we're saying is that we have these pumps whose role is to pump hydrogen, but we have to get electrons into them. So we have these little carriers that carry electrons from one to the next, and then so on and so forth, cutting them across. So their role is to kind of do that. They're moving electrons across. A buildup, of course, again, one electron carrier ferries electrons from the first to the second, and a second carrier from the second to the third. This, of course, results in a buildup of hydrogen on one side of the membrane, which allows for a positive charge, where the other side has a more negative charge. So the fact that we have more hydrogen on one side than the other means outside is more positive and the inside is considered to be negative. When we have, well, how many people here know about a car battery? What do you know about a car battery? How many people here have had to boost a car? Right? So you have a red side and a black side. What's the red side? Positive, and the black side is? Right. If you didn't have positive and negative in the battery, guess what? You wouldn't have a charge. Right? Make sense now? So you have to have a charge difference on either side of the membrane. That's where the energy comes from. Just like your car battery. You have to have positive things and negative things in the car battery in order to actually get a charge out of the battery. Okay? You have to have that difference. Same as your Duracell in whatever device you're using. You have a positive end to a battery and a negative end to a battery, don't you? You have to have both in order to maintain the charge. Okay? It's more complicated than that, but just understand you have a distinct charge difference between the two, and the same things happen here at the membrane. By pumping hydrogen on one side, hydrogen is a positive ion. Therefore, because there's more hydrogen, outside is considered to be more positive, inside more negative. Therefore, because we have a differential of charge, we have a energy, we have charge. Okay? So we say then that the gradient has a potential charge. Same thing happens when a muscle contracts. You have to have a potential difference for charge for that to occur as well. Okay? Where the specific channel exists, hydrogen can diffuse back across the membrane driven by the proton force, which is diffusion, right? Simple fact that if there's less on one side than the other, it's going to want to move around. So again, what's really cool about this is the mitochondria uses the laws of diffusion to its advantage because hydrogen wants to move across. And it gives it just one place to go through. It's like herding cattle into a truck. You put them in a corner and you keep getting them tighter, and if there's only one way to get to the truck, guess what? For a place of least resistance, then the cattle will go up that chute. Well, hydrogen will do the same thing because there's a molecule there that accepts these hydrogen that want to move across. As the hydrogen diffuses back across, they generate ATP because the channels contain an enzyme ATP synthase. This enzyme uses that proton force to synthesize ATP from ADP and P. The process is responsible for most of the ATP produced cellular respiration. We have to remember, the two NADH produced in the cytosol during glycolysis cannot themselves enter the mitochondria. They donate their electrons to transfer molecules. So when we create NADH, what we're doing is we're giving ourselves an opportunity to release electrons. And if you saw, remember in the video you saw, it was electrons that were actually carrying hydrogen across from one side of the complex to the other. Did you take note of that? Don't worry, we'll go back to the video again. So, these various electron transfers generate 32 or 34 ATP from each molecule of glucose. From the 10 molecules of NADH plus hydrogen, 28 or 30 ATP are produced, and two more from the FADH2. So then we can say, during aerobic respiration, 36 or 38 ATP can be generated from one molecule of glucose. And how many ATP were created in anaerobic metabolism just with glycolysis? Right? There were four with a net gain of two. Remember? Created four, but you needed two to create the process. So in other words, without aerobic respiration or metabolism, we're doomed. We would never create enough ATP to do all the functions the body does. So we require this. So this is why certain areas of the body rely completely on aerobic metabolism, such as the heart. Because there's not enough ATP generated for a heart to maintain contractions and beats for your entire lifetime, or for 5 minutes for that matter. It relies on aerobic metabolism to create this vast amount of ATP. Now remember, we're only talking one mitochondria here. What did I say about mitochondria in some cells? Hundreds. So imagine how many ATP, depending on the type of tissue we're talking about and the kind of cells in there, you know, you start adding this all up. There are some areas of the body that, you know, cells are creating vast amounts of ATP for function. Okay? Okay, so we're going to go back here again to the video. Watch it again. There's two of them. That's okay. I'm going to turn this off for a moment. Okay, we are good to go. We have just a couple things to talk about. So, what was the main fuel source for all of this? By the way, for those who were a little bit later into class before it started, I found this in class. Okay, I knew it belonged here somewhere. Okay, what's this whole system use as fuel? Glucose. Therefore, then how can carbohydrates and lipids be fuel? If glucose is the main source for a Krebs cycle electron transport chain, we have to do something to proteins and lipids in order to make them the appropriate fuel for it. Let me ask you a question. Between carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins, what contains the highest amount of energy? Between fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, which one of those three has the most energy per mole, per molecule? Nope. Fat. Anybody know what the calculation is? 4 cals in carbohydrates and proteins, and 8 in fats. If you tried to light a piece of steak on fire, how easily would it burn? Kind of does if you had barbecues on too hot, right? What would happen if you mistakenly poured a vat of hot oil into an open fire? What would happen? It's like a gasoline. right? That's how much energy is in fat. Fat provides a huge amount of energy compared to carbohydrates and proteins, okay? So from a physiological point of view, if we have too many calories in our day-to-day life compared to what we burn, the body doesn't want to get rid of that excess calories because we've been genetically set up through evolution to store, because our species has spent very many, many years in the past starving to death half the time because, you know, you could only put down a woolly mammoth every once in a while, and we weren't really farmers yet, and we were subsisting with whatever we could get our hands on. So we had times where we would starve basically to death. So the body had to learn, how do I store energy? Well, stored energy in humans is what? Fat. And so that's why we have fat, because it's stored energy for a rainy day if we need it for something, such as creating ATP, right? So something has to happen to that fat in order to be able to go into this whole system. Gluconeogenesis is when we have too little glucose to stoke this metabolic furnace. Glycerol and amino acids are converted to glucose. So glycerol comes out of fat, and amino acids come out of proteins. Remember, proteins are strings of amino acids. We talked about that when we did protein synthesis, right? So the process of forming new sugar from non-carbohydrate molecules is called gluconeogenesis, and all of this occurs in the liver. So we have to convert these other fuel sources to be able to go into this whole process we just talked about to create ATP. Of course, it protects the body, the nervous system in particular, from the damaging effects of low blood sugar by ensuring ATP production can continue. So your brain utilizes pretty much 100% glucose. Otherwise, you run out of sugars. Right? How many people here get up Sunday morning, a couple cups of coffee, haven't really eaten anything, and you suddenly get in this really foul mood? You haven't eaten all morning, and you're just bitchy. Right, everything's just short-tempered and everything, right? Hangry, right? What does that mean? It means your blood sugar is low and your brain's not getting enough, and that's why you're hangry. You have your breakfast, and how do you feel? Usually, pretty good, right? You're back to normal again, and away you go. Your brain is glucose hungry. It wants glucose all the time in order to function properly. So that's why we need to get glucose from other fuel sources to maintain not only just the creation of ATP in other cells, but also our brain as well. So lipid metabolism. Of course, fats are the body's most concentrated form of energy. They contain very little water, and the energy yield is twice that of either glucose or protein. Basically, there's 9 kcal per gram of fat compared to 4 per gram of carbohydrates or protein. So there's twice the amount of energy in fat that we can utilize at any given time. Most of the products of fat digestion are transported in the lymph in the form of a fatty protein droplet called a chylomicron. Now, what's very interesting here is that fats, carbohydrates, go all well, their pathways through your gut, but fats actually go into lymph and are traveled through your lymph system to be metabolized by the liver. So you actually, when you have a high-fat diet, you create this milky liquid that comes out of the intestines, goes into the lymph system, and heads over to the liver to be dealt with, okay? Eventually, the lipids in the chylomicrons are hydrolyzed by plasma enzymes, and the resulting fatty acids and glycerol are taken up by the body cells where they're then processed. So we have to take the fats we eat in our diet, and we have to convert them into either fatty acids or glycerol. That's the forms of storage that can go into the next step of storage. So we have to do that to it. So how fat is the North American diet? Yeah, so your liver's doing a lot of work in North American diet. Okay. In fact, what happens is we overproduce so much of it that it gets stuck in the bloodstream, not in the lymph. This is why we get fatty streaks in our coronary arteries and such, because this high fat diet is, we just overabundantly have it, and it gets all stuck in our blood vessels and then starts to create plaques and causes all sorts of nasty problems, which can end up in a heart attack or a stroke or anything like that. Okay. Lipids can be oxidized to form ATP. If the fats are not needed, of course, then they're created in adipose tissue. And we are very efficient at creating adipose tissue. because genetically and evolutionarily we've had to, because we, as I say, we've starved half to death most of the time, and we've learned how to store really well. And some of us, unfortunately, genetically are really good, even more efficient at storing fat than others, right? You know, how many of you have friends, or how many ourselves go, you know, it's Christmas and I really cut back. I didn't want to put any weight on. I barely ate and didn't drink any alcohol, but I still put on 6 pounds. Right? It happens because you're genetically, it's your body's just genetically doing what it wants to do. And then we load it up with this whole cultural side that says you're supposed to be 95 pounds and, you know, that's what's attractive and all this other BS that society talks about. That's completely untrue. And then so that puts us in these terrible positions where, you know, we don't match whatever society says we're supposed to and all the other junk that goes with it, especially with girls. I raised two daughters. I have a fairly intimate understanding of what happens to women and when they're growing up. Some lipids are used as structural molecules or to synthesize other essential substances. I mean, this is the other thing. If way back in the day when we talked about, you know, lowering fat intake, you know, when it came out there back in the 70s that, you know, high fat diet equals heart disease and all those sorts of things. Well, then there was this movement initially in reaction to say no fat diet. We can't have no fat diets. It is very unhealthy for us. Ladies, estrogen is produced out of lipids. And without fat, you can't produce estrogen. So estrogen is also stored in adipose tissue. This is why females have a greater percentage of fat for a number of reasons as compared to males, because it's required for your physiology. So what happens to, for example, marathon women who are down to like 1% body fat? What's one thing they can't do? Have a period, because it changes their physiology and they're unable to have normal physiology because the female physiology requires stored fat to produce things such as hormones like estrogen in order to function properly. The main function of adipose tissue is to remove triglycerides from chylomicrons and very low density lipoproteins and store them until they're needed for ATP production. That's the whole purpose of adipose tissue. Adipose tissue, of course, is, say it, fat. It's fat. It's fat. Okay? See, fat tastes good. I like fat. If I buy a steak or a pork chop, I want lots of fat on it. That's the good stuff. Right? Now, VLDLs, very low density lipoproteins, are actually not very good ones. They're the ones that can result in heart disease. So we have VLDLs and HLDLs. So HDLs, high density lipoproteins, are the good guys. So anybody here, you're probably all too young to have had a lipid profile yet. I doubt it, probably just me because of my age. But males at my age, we have to have our yearly blood work done, and they do what's called a lipid profile, and they look at HDLs and VLDLs and LDLs and all sorts of things. And they do like a ratio mathematical thing, and it potentially can kind of suggest your potential for heart disease, right? So we want to get rid of VLDLs and LDLs. Those are not the good ones. And we want to see nice HDLs as far as that goes. So examples of a VLDL, does anybody know? It was in the news a number of years ago. In fact, some of them have been outlawed. That'll help. Come on, the fats were outlawed 2 years ago. Sorry? Somebody said them. Made French fries out of them and all those sorts of things. What's that? No, corn oil's not too bad. Hydrolyzed fats, like margarine, that kind of stuff. Anything that changes the chemical parts of it. Whereas everybody's heard of the European diet, right? What's one thing that's good about the European diet? I use a lot of it. Olive oil. Olive oil is not bad for you. It doesn't produce the same amounts of these bad fats that we eat. So anything that goes kind of hard, like beef fat at room temperature, beef fat, pork fat, those sorts of things, those are not good for us because they clog up arteries. Whereas things like avocado oil, peanut oil, olive oil, those are oils you can use quite frequently and be okay with it. If you take bad fats and make them super hot, even that's even worse, because you actually change the chemical compound of fat that you're eating. So ultimately, the body doesn't know that. It just knows it's fat. It says, hey, lots of energy, and there it goes. Yeah. Very low density lipoproteins. So there's LDLs, low density lipoproteins, and then very low density lipoproteins, and then HDLs, which are the good ones, which are high density lipoproteins. Those are the good ones. So, of the various lipids, only neutral fats, triglycerides, are routinely oxidized for energy. So, what we have to do then, we have to take neutral fats and we have to catabolize them. So, catabolic reactions do what? Break down. Right. So, catabolism of neutral fats involves separate oxidation of their two different building blocks, glycerol and fatty acids. And oxidation is what? It's the addition of oxygen. Correct. Okay. Most cells of the body convert glycerol to glyceraldehyde phosphate. And glyceraldehyde phosphate is the intermediate which then flows into the Krebs cycle as one of the chemical reactions. So we have to take fats, okay, we have to take glycerol and fatty acids, and we take that glycerol and we convert it into glyceraldehyde phosphate. And then glyceraldehyde phosphate can easily flow into the Krebs cycle and into the reactions to create the NADH and the FADH and the hydrogen that's required by the electron transport chain. Make sense kind of now? Okay? Because the whole thing is, we need fuel sources to create hydrogen and these enzymes, FADH and NADH. That's the whole purpose of all of this. So when you have stored fat in your body, it's your body's just saying, there's energy here to utilize. I can pump a lot of hydrogen with that gram of fat. So I'm going to store it for a rainy day and then break it down and use it in the Krebs cycle and electron transport chain to create the ATP that I require. Okay? Glyceraldehyde is equal to half a glucose molecule. So now you have to cut it in half, which means you're only going to produce how many acetylcholine? One. Therefore, how many ATP in anaerobic metabolism? One. And how many ATP in the Krebs cycle electron transport chain? 16 or 17. Okay? So you can see, it provides, but glycerol or glucose is still the better. The initial phase of fatty acid oxidation occurs in the mitochondria, and there are many types of reactions in this process, but the net result is that fatty acids are broken apart into two carbon acidic acid fragments, and then we have reduced coenzymes that are produced. The acetic acid molecule that's formed through beta oxidation fuses to a coenzyme forming acetyl-CoA. So you can see that when we need that acetyl-CoA, right, in the presence of oxygen, pyruvic acid becomes acetyl-CoA. And we need acetyl-CoA to enter into the Krebs cycle, oxaloacetic acid, again, ultimately to produce FADH, NADH, and hydrogen atoms, right? That's the whole purpose. So we're saying that we get these fatty acids that are broken apart into two carbon acidic acid fragments, and then we get reduced coenzymes, and then the acetic acid molecule is formed through beta oxidation that fuses to CoA, forming acetyl-CoA. We then have a removal of one pair of carbon at a time from the long chain of carbon atoms that compose fatty acids through these various reactions. A 16-carbon fatty acid. Now, we have to understand that when we look at like fatty acids, we see how many carbons it is in a chain. You know, I'm not going to examine you on this, but just understand that when we look at these from a chemical point of view, how many carbons are there in this molecule? Palmitic acid, right, is a 16-carbon fatty acid. In other words, when we looked at it, there's 16 carbon chains in that palmitic acid, okay? That means that having 16 carbon palmitic acid, it can yield 129 ATP molecules via this beta oxidation, the Krebs cycle, and the electron transport chain. So you can see that lipids, fatty acids, because of these high carbons, you can see how many ATP can be created using fat and the energy that's in fat, right? So it's highly beneficial to use it. But here's the problem. How long does it take before you start using fat as a fuel source when you're exercising? You're out for a run, getting the sweat on. How long does it take before you stop using glucose and convert to fat? 15 to 20 minutes. 15 to 20 minutes. So that means that Big Mac that you ate last night, if you're out for a 20-minute run, you ain't using the Big Mac. This is why people exercise and they go, oh my God, I'm not losing anything here, right? It's consistency over time. But again, it's a teeter-totter, right? What do you take in? What do you burn off? Right? Portion control. Every once in a while, you can have a Big Mac if you like that kind of stuff or whatever. But you can understand that, you know, 20 minutes before you even start to utilize those fat stores on your body, you're not even going to get to them for 20 minutes. So as I said, you're out for exercise and a run, 21, 22 minutes, you're maybe a minute and a half into doing the Pac-Man on your fat to try to utilize energy to do your exercise. So it's not fair, because how long does it take to eat a Big Mac? Not 20 minutes, yeah. Well, it's a good question, because when I used to do exercise training, we always believed, we used target heart rate, right? Everybody knows about target heart rate, 220 minus age, 10% age, all that kind of stuff, okay? So we used to say the lower 50 to 65% was for weight loss, 65 to 70% was for cardiac fitness, and then above that was for high performance, right? So getting really strong, whatever. Well, in my experience, because I put a lot of people in that lower heart rate, they wouldn't lose a damn thing. But then HIIT came along, right? And everybody's following HIIT, and it's kind of working, right? We're into high-intensity, almost anaerobic workouts, and it seems to metabolically change things, and the body reaches into fat stores in order to perform. This is why HIIT's working well. The problem with HIIT, though, on the other side, though, is the greater potential for injury. This is why I do not like CrossFit. I apologize if anybody here is into CrossFit. If you're able to do it, great. But the problem with CrossFit is I don't believe that they take the time to look at the person in front of them to recognize that you really can't do this sort of thing because you're really going to hurt yourself. Doing deadlifts like 40 times and you're not in shape just scares the hell out of me. I don't like deadlifts anyways. But yeah. Well, like I say, the Benjamin Franklin rule, everything in moderation. But that's where HIIT is now becoming a bit popular. But again, controlled, right? So like us, like all of you, I realize that exercise is part of our scope of practice. We can give exercise prescription in the presence of pathologies. That's part of what we're going to be able to do. You guys are going to be taking a whole new course in this new curriculum in semester three called remedial exercise. So you're going to learn how to do certain things from an exercise prescriptive thing. Because I just going to keep saying this because I'm just going to plant the seed and hopefully put it in as hard as possible. Putting a patient on a table for 55 minutes naked and rubbing them with lotion every single time, that's only like that much of who we are, but that's what everybody does. You see those exercise equipment in the clinic? You see anybody using it? No, and it drives me bonkers. So I don't know if I told you about the 5 patients per day, per hour sort of thing. All of you want to make money, right, at massage? How much does it cost for an hour massage? $100. Okay? How many massages can you do an hour? Okay. So now you know you can do exercise prescription as part of your scope of practice. Imagine, if you will, that in your clinic, wherever you're working, you put in an exercise gym, a treadmill, a bicycle, and some kind of funky cable sort of thing. And I can take 5 patients and put 5 patients in that room and work them out for an hour. And under my scope of practice, how much can I charge? $100 an hour. If times 5 patients is $500 an hour. Remember that. Remember that. Take that away. Take that away. Because all of you will find so many massage therapists do not fulfill their full scope of practice because they feel that they're pressured by patients. Just put them on the table and rub them. There's nothing wrong with the techniques you're learning in any way, shape, or form. They're highly beneficial. Patients benefit from them. But at the end of the day, usually getting them off their duff and moving their bodies and exercising and doing things along with your treatments is how you get a patient better, not just getting on the table once a week and rubbing them down. And that goes for chiropractic as well. Going every once a week and getting cracked. Makes you feel good. It's lovely, but does it solve the problem? Likely not. You need to get up, move your body, do some exercise, and so forth. So remember that, $500 an hour. So triglyceride triglycerides, synthesis, or lipogenesis occurs when cellular ATP and glucose levels are high. So excess ATP leads to an accumulation of the intermediates of glucose metabolism, acetyl-CoA and glyceraldehyde, which would feed back into the Krebs cycle. So now we're in a period of time where you're not needing much ATP. All of a sudden you have all this glyceraldehyde and lipoproteins and so forth, and you're not using them. So what happens to them? When they are present in excess, the two metabolites are channeled into pathways leading to triglyceride synthesis. Because acetyl-CoA is the intermediate glucose metabolism, it's also the starting point for synthesis of fatty acids. In other words, glucose is easily converted to fat. So when you're sitting on your duff, how much ATP are you using compared to when you're outside working in the garden or going for a walk? Not near as much. You've had a nice big lunch today. You're sitting here doing nothing. What's happening to all those calories you took at lunch? The body's saying, now we're not producing much ATP, so therefore I'm going to make fat because I don't need it for a rainy day. Okay? Therefore, glucose is easily converted to fat. Thus, if the diet is fat poor, excessive carbohydrate intake provides all the raw materials needed to form neutral fats. So we actually can take and go the other way. We can take carbohydrates and create fat. Now, right now, for whatever reason, the new theory suggests, inappropriately, that carbohydrates are bad and you should go back to proteins again. Yeah? Everybody's hearing that? BS. You need a full, balanced diet. This idea of all these new things that come up, eat raw, eat proteins, eat carbs, don't eat proteins, high fat, low fat, blah, blah, blah. Your body knows how to deal with all of it. We need all of those things because not only do, you know, they can be a bit detrimental to some degree in terms of putting fat on and those sorts of things, they also provide a lot of times a lot of nutrients, vitamins, compounds, and so forth that you can only get from one and not from another. It's all about moderation and balance between the two of them. And again, that teeter-totter, how much you're burning and how much you're taking in. Right? Everybody in this program, even me, put on anywhere from 15 to 20 pounds in the program. Because what are you spending most of your time doing? Sitting, reading a book. How many people here are finding they're reading a lot of junk food? More than they ever did. I have a theory on that. I think it's because you're working your brain so high, it's screaming. Because I'm not a junk food guy, but when I was studying for massage, man, I just wolfing stuff down like crazy. I know maybe you need it. Lipolysis is the breakdown of stored fats into glycerol and fatty acids. So this, lipogenesis, is when we are not requiring ATP, and how do we convert carbohydrates and proteins into fat? Now we're needing ATP. How do we break down stored fats? Because we're at the 20-minute mark, we've been using sugars, now we need our fat stores to get at energy. The products, it's a breakdown, lipolysis is a breakdown of stored fats into glycerol and fatty acids. They are then released into the blood, which allows access to fat fuels for aerobic metabolism. The liver, cardiac muscle, and resting skeletal muscle prefer fatty acids as a fuel source. So that's their preferred fuel for creating ATP. So obviously we are times where we are breaking down fat if required. Proteins. Now, proteins have a limited lifespan and must be broken down into their amino acids and replaced before they begin to deteriorate. So think about that. You cook the steak, you have a nice couple of glasses of wine, you're kind of tired, and you'll get to that steak sometime tomorrow, and it's in the middle of summer, and it's 90 degrees out, and the steak's outside on the picnic table, and what's it smell like the next morning? That's how quickly proteins break down. Same as us. When you die, you'll start to smell kind of off within hours because proteins break down so quickly, so quickly. So we have to be able to deal with proteins and its associated amino acids very quickly when we look at them. So newly ingested amino acids transported in the blood are taken up by cells by active transport and used to replace tissue proteins at a rate of approximately 100 grams per day. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're taking protein supplements to the tune of 50 or 60 grams of protein a day, you have the most expensive feces on the planet because you're not utilizing half of them. You're pooping them all out. So this idea, you know, all these protein powdered shakes and everything that are these vast amounts of protein, even if your weight, if you're bodybuilding, there would be bodybuilders who would argue with me on this, you don't need as many proteins as you think you do. Because you're also getting, remember, you're also getting them from other places in your diet, right? And you have to account for that. So, okay. When more protein is ingested than is needed, amino acids are oxidized for energy or they're converted to fat. So, before amino acids can be oxidized for energy, they must be deaminated. In other words, the amine group must be removed. You've all seen an example of deamination. Do you know what it is? What happens to egg white when you fry it? It goes from what to what? Clear to white. That's what you're doing. You're removing the amine group with high heat when you cook the egg. Can you make the white back to white, clear again? Because you've already removed it chemically, okay? So that's what's happening. So we have to do the same thing when you're eating food. The resulting molecule then is converted to pyruvic acid or one of the keto acid intermediates in the Krebs cycle. So by doing that, we can then drop it into the Krebs cycle at certain points to make it work. Again, create. Remember, this is all about creating ATP through the Krebs cycle, creating NADH, FADH, and hydrogen, right? Alcohol. What about alcohol? What do you think happens to alcohol? Does alcohol have a high calorie content? Yes. What happens if you light a match to a cup of vodka? It burns pretty good, right? Anybody here of Italian persuasion whose family makes grappa? Grappa. There's no Italians in this class? Grappa is made from skins of grapes. You distill skins of grapes and you make liquor out of it. Quite good, actually, but it can get quite high in alcohol. So, when you drink alcohol, yes? I didn't put this up? Okay, I'll do it here in a second. I'll put it up. When you drink alcohol, the body goes, you have lots of calories, but you're not a fat, you're not a protein, and you're not a carbohydrate. So, but you got lots of energy, so I'm going to go directly to alcohol's pathway is pretty close to quickly going into becoming adipose tissue. Again, because the body recognizes the calories are in it and breaks it down and utilizes it. So it's one of those things that this is why, you know, you get the beer belly and all those sorts of things with alcohol. So just give me half a second. I'll stop this and I'll upload this. In this room is taken mitosis and meiosis, correct? It's like what, grade 9, grade 10, something like that, somewhere in there. Maybe you guys can teach me what's the acronym for this PMAT? What's that? Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase? Or telophase, depending on your teacher was. Okay. So there's two main parts to the cell's life cycle. I mean, cells die and reproduce and so forth. Mitosis and cytokinesis. Now, cytokinesis are the changes that occur in the cytoplasm during cell division. So a whole bunch of things need to happen within a cell before it splits into two. So the movement of organelles, the duplication of organelles, the creation of the mitotic spindle, and so forth, are all known as cytokinesis. The only cells which do not follow the process of the normal cell cycle are sex cells, which represent the sperm in males or the ovum in females. And that's what meiosis is, and we'll be talking about that after this. Different cells have varying life cycle durations. So, for example, in your mouth, you have epithelial tissue in your mouth. How long, if you take a chunk out of your cheek or your lip, how long does that take to heal compared to your finger? Right, because there's a lot of cellular turnover in this tissue, so any damage to it heals quite quickly, whereas when you cut your finger, the cell turnover is a little bit slower, so it takes some time. And some cells don't even heal at all. You have them in there forever. So different cells have varying life cycle durations. Epithelial cells have a lifespan of a few days, while a neuron lasts several decades. And for those who are interested, cellular nervous cells, neurons in your brain, you have them from when you were born until you die. So if you enjoy copious amounts of alcohol, cannabis, recreational medications, those sorts of things, if you kill brain cells, which you will do with any of those substances, you'll never get those back again. Now you have lots to work with, but certain drugs like meth destroy neurons very quickly, and you don't get those back. And this is why people who do meth tend to be really, really badly affected neurologically, and their brains become basically toast, right? Because they kill so many brain cells and they're not replaced. So in a 24-hour period, the body loses billions of cells from varying parts of the body. So cells are constantly dying and being replaced in your body even now as we speak. When we look at this, we look at a 24-hour cycle. So we sort of represent it in this circle, sort of representing a 24-hour clock if we used to use it that. And depending on which part we're talking about within the cycle, we give it certain periods of time, meaning, you know, how long it spends in each one. So interphase is the longest part of a cell's life, okay? Interphase represents a cell that is not preparing for or in division, right? So that neuron I'm talking about that was created inside mom and you're caring for life is in interphase for 80, 90 years if you live that long. Okay, it doesn't ever set up again. This is why folks with, for example, with spinal cord injuries, this is why we can't heal them. Because there's no ability for the cell to multiply or reproduce itself to fix wherever the injury was in the spinal column or spinal cord. This is why we can't fix them. Lots of research in trying to figure this out, but at this point we still are not able to do that. So therefore it accounts for approximately 90 to 95% of that 24-hour clock. So quite a large time of it. Now, in interphase, right? So cells not in interphase, it's not duplicating or it's not dividing. If a cell is attempting to divide, it has to go through a number of steps in interphase before it divides. The first is called growth one. So if a cell that is in interphase is going to divide, it has to go through growth one. So this phase is directly after mitosis cytokinesis. Remember, mitosis is a division and the movement of the organelles within the cell. We get significant growth here, and it produces the substances that will be required if the cell enters into another division. So in growth one, we'll get duplication of mitochondria, we get the two mitotic spindles created, and so forth. Okay? So we get that. There's usually the shortest stage, whether the life is long or short. A spinal nerve cell can remain in G1 for 80 years. So when we say G1 of a neuron, it's just that the neuron matures and gets older. It doesn't get into creating things for a next division. It's just after it's been created, then it just kind of grows and stays there. Okay? So this represents approximately 8 to 10 hours of the 24. So we can see here growth 1 in the cycle, right here, this sort of part right here. And you can see interphase is running from growth 1 all the way around till we start getting into where cell division is actually occurring. Two is synthesis. So if the cell is going to divide, knowing it's going to divide, DNA molecules have to double. Why? Why do we need two sets of genetic material? Sorry? Well, yeah, why though? Because each cell has to have a full complement of genetic material to be okay and normal. Right, so if we're going to take a single cell and make two, there has to be the same genetic material in the first cell as there is in the two. So we have to double up genetic material in order to divide the two cells having the appropriate amount of DNA. So the DNA molecules doubles, as do the centrosomes and the centrioles, because they're going to make those mitotic spindles. Then now it's preparing for cellular division, and it's approximately 6 to 8 hours of the 24. And then finally, after we've hit growth one, then we have synthesis, then we have to go into growth two. It's the final step before we actually go into mitosis cytokinesis. We have a little more growth here of the cell, and this represents about 4 to 6 hours of the 24. So all three of these, G1, synthesis, and G2 all represent interphase. Okay? So now we're going to move into the cells going to divide. The mitosis, cytokinesis. Mitosis is the term for the division of the nucleus. And cytokinesis represents the cytoplasm, the division of all the cytoplasmic material, which is all the things that we find between the nucleus and the cell membrane, organelles and so forth, Golgi apparatus and all those sorts of things. Biologically, it's the most important stage, and within this mitosis cytokinesis, there are four stages. Chronologically, and this is in order, we have prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. So things happen within each of these stages as the cell is progressing to dividing. We do not have a blend between one and the other. So I'll leave that for you guys to watch. It's just sort of going to talk about what we talk about. So the first stage then is prophase. So obviously when we're going to subdivide a cell, what do we need to ensure? That both cells are what? Don't get complicated. Both cells have to be what? Functional, normal. So if I have a stomach cell that's going to divide, what do I want? Two. I have a stomach cell that's going to divide. What do I want? Two. Stomach cells. Right. I want to have two of the same. Okay, so we want to ensure that if that, you know, we want that extra cell we've just created going to be a stomach cell, that it's a viable stomach cell. The reason I'm saying that to you is because in cancer, what happens is you get cellular division with a mutation. So the cell that gets produced, or the cells that get produced possibly, are no longer stomach cells. They're a tumor cell. The reason why you die most of the time with cancer is because what was once a stomach is no longer a stomach. Or what was a lung is not a lung. Or what was a brain is not a brain. Because the cells mutate and they're no longer viable cells that make up the tissue of the organ that has started to mutate. And at the end of the day, if you don't have a stomach, you're going to live. Or a brain, likely not. So this is what tends to get us. So we want to ensure that when two cells divide, we have two appropriate cells that are functional within the tissue that they're dividing in. So initially, the chromatin begins to condense and coil to form chromosomes. What did I liken chromatin to? A bowl of spaghetti. So when we look at those strings of spaghetti, if we wanted to double that material and keep it intact and less chance of it breaking apart in doing so, I need to condense that spaghetti. In other words, I have to take that now twice-sized bowl of spaghetti and condense it down into smaller workable parts, okay? Remember the histones I talked about that were a protein that wrapped around the DNA molecule, right? So, initially the chromatin begins to condense and coil to form chromosomes. Now, it doubles during interphase, and the chromosomes that appear are formed from two chromatids. So we have to understand that in G1, because the cell was going to divide, we had to take all the genetic material and double it. We had to double it. Okay? So we had to create a whole set of DNA for the new cell that's being created here. The two chromatids are joined together by a central structure known as the centromere. So here is, shall we say, the original DNA molecule. Because remember, a DNA molecule is unbelievably large molecule. And we have to pull it in to make it workable. So this has all been twisted and condensed around these histones to pack it all in. So let's just say, for example, this left one was the original DNA, and this is the duplicate that was created during G1. So we have, they're two the same, right? They're identical to each other. And they just kind of come together, and they get put together here at the center, known as the centromere, right? So they get kind of put together. So the two chromatids are joined by a central structure known as the centromere. Now, on the outer aspect of the centromere on either side are these kind of greenish ball areas here, and these are known as kinetochores, okay? Now, the kinetochores find attachment at the center near the centromere. what has going to happen, see if you guys remember this, when the cell really does start to physically divide, what's going to happen to this structure? The right one is going to go in what direction? Right? Right. They're going to get pulled apart. Okay? So what happens is, although they're joined at the centromere, the two kinetochores, okay, that sort of are this globular center part, you'll see they're connected to kinetochore microtubules. Those kinetochore microtubules go into the mitotic spindle. Think of it as a pulley system, where those microtubules start getting pulled, the mitotic spindle, thus putting tension on the kinetochores, and the two get pulled apart so that they go to either side of the two new cells that are going to be there. Make sense to everybody? Okay. So on the outer aspect are either side of the kinetochores, and they act as a site of attachment for the kinetochore microtubules. In the later parts of prophase, the nuclear envelope starts to disappear, as does the nucleolus. So this is all happening in an intact nucleus. And then once that all gets kind of done, the centromeres and the kinetochores and the condensing of the chromatin, then once that's all done, the membrane around the nucleus, it dissolves and disappears. Okay? At about the same time, the centrioles migrate to the opposite poles, and the two centrioles migrate, they form the mitotic spindles. So the centromeres now start to do and mature into what they're going to do, because their role is to pull the genetic material apart. The spindle is a spindle-shaped collection of microtubules, and there are three main microtubules associated with the spindle. So we can see here that here is our kinetochores here, right? Remember the kinetochores, this kind of green area here, sort of represented here with the orange circles. And then the centrosome has migrated two of them, one to each end, right? And they're you're going to see eventually attach here. Oops, what did I do here? Okay. So we said here that there are three main microtubules associated with the spindle. The first are non-kinetochore microtubules. What was that green area called at the center of the genetic material? That's the kinetochore, right? So if they're called non-kinetochore, what likely don't they attach to? The kinetochore, right? So the non-kinetochore microtubules project from the centrioles into the center, but they don't attach to the kinetochores. Whereas the kinetochore microtubules, they likely attach to the kinetochores. Right? So they project also from the centriole to the center, but they do connect with the kinetochore on both sides of the centrosome. So we can see here that we've got this lining up of the genetic material. These kinetochore microtubules go over here to the centrosome, centriole over here, and these ones head over to the one on this side. So we can see them here and here. We've got the centrosome spindles, one in each pole, with these non-kinetochore microtubules kind of out here. And then we've got these kinetochore microtubules, this bottom one attaching to this kinetochore on this side of the lining up of the genetic material. And on, from this one, we've got them lined up on this side. You can see when they both pull, they're going to rip the two of them apart away from each other, heading to either pole as the cells divide. Yes? Okay. Just review for everybody. Yes, no, maybe. Kind of, sort of. Okay. Now, there are astral microtubules, and they go out the back. So they radiate out from the centrioles, but not to the center. These help form the mitotic spindle, which helps pull the chromatids to the opposite poles of the cell. Under a microscope, this is how significant they are. They're quite larger than what any sort of drawing gives you. So you can see here is your mitotic spindles here. Here's your kinetochore, non-kinetochore microtubules here. And out the back, you can see the astrals back here on the backside. Here, the same thing. Blue represent the kinetochore, non-kinetochore. Here's the mitotic spindle here. And then these are your astral spindles, tubules, out here in the back in green. Okay? So these attach. We have these this genetic material kind of stuck together with the centrosome and the kinetochore. And then these mitotic chromosomes line up across the mid-region of the cell, known as the equatorial plane. Now, the spindle has grown to its full size. We can see the genetic material kind of lining up, lining up down that plane. So we think if we've got, you know, we've got these genetic material, one over top of the other, we've got a big circle, and we think of a line through the equatorial part of the cell, and the genetic material all lines up, one facing this side, mitotic spindle on this side, the genetic material facing this one, the kinetochore microtubules have come and attached to the kinetochores, and again, they start to do their job, they start pulling at both sides of these the genetic material, breaking them apart at the centromere. So this DNA chromosome goes this way, this one goes that way, all the way down the ones that are lined up. And how many do we have? How many do we have? Anybody remember? How many are going to line up? Okay, we'll get to it. Anaphase begins with the mitotic chromosomes being pulled apart at the centromere. They are now chromatids, also called daughter chromosomes, that are drawn to opposite poles by the shortening of the kinetochore microtubules and the lengthening of the non-kinetochore microtubules. Therefore, we end up with 46 chromatids on one side and 46 chromatids on the other. There are 23 pairs of chromosomes in a normal viable cell. But before we started to divide, what did that have to do? It had to double in interphase. So then we went to 46. So we need 23 pairs on any cell to be viable. Every functional cell in your body has a normal viable DNA in it, which means there's 23 pairs of chromosomes. Every cell in your body. Okay, everybody sort of, you know, watch crime shows now, everybody sort of DNA testing. Right, we all have different DNA. And we have similarities in some cases, especially to our family members, but we still have our own DNA. So this is why they can, you know, if you're going to leave at a site, like a crime site, whether that be sperm or blood or those sorts of things, they're able to take those, they can look at the DNA within those, the cells within that sort of material, and then they can look at your DNA and doing just a swab in the inside of the cheek. And if the DNA matches, it's not going to be too easy to fight that because it's pretty straightforward. So we have 46 chromatids on one, 46 chromatids on the other. And then what happens is when we get to the later part of anaphase, these chromatids are almost at either pole of the large cell. And then what happens is that big circle, as the genetic material gets out to the ends, in the middle, we start to get this cleavage form. So it's starting to, the membrane's starting to come in from both sides, and they'll eventually meet in the center. And that happens as telophase. So at telophase, each pole has 46 chromatids, as I said. As soon as the chromosomes are no longer migrating, we enter telophase, and what happens is everything reverses back. The genetic material that's all condensed by the histones, it starts to break apart, and you start going from chromatids to basically into chromatin. So the chromosomes begin to uncoil back to chromatin. We start to get a nuclear envelope that surrounds this material. We get the nucleolus beginning to form within the nucleus. The mitotic spindle is done with its job, so it starts breaking down. We don't see it much anymore. The cleavage furrow increases until there is now two distinct cells. And when we have two distinct cells, we call those daughter cells. So when a cell is divided into two, those two new cells are called daughter cells. Okay? These cells are said to be diploid because they will have two of each of the chromosomes. Pairs 1 to 22, and then what we traditionally call the sex pair, right? So, as I said, that's what's considered a viable amount of DNA in a cell to be viable. So you have every cell in your body has 22 pairs, with the 23rd being the sex representing gender, okay? Now, cytokinesis, of course, we have to remember, you know, we talked entirely there about genetic material as a cell divides, but we had Golgi apparatus, smooth and rough endoplasmic reticulum, what happens to all that stuff? We have to have division of those. So cytokinesis is the division of the cell cytoplasm, which includes the organelles. This doesn't begin until the formation of the cleavage furrow. So what the cell does, it separates it out so there's no potential for damage to genetic material. So when the genetic material is doing its thing in cellular division, we don't start to see duplication and movement of organelles until the genetic material is done and starts to form the nuclear envelope and so forth. It's almost like there's this conscious awareness to get the DNA material, the genetic material, dealt with first so that no organelle is going to bump into it and screw it up and break it and do all that kind of stuff, okay? So that cytokinesis happens after that. Late anaphase, the cleavage furrow is starting to come together. Genetic material is now getting in behind a nuclear envelope, and now we start to see the movement of organelles going into the cells. Any questions? I don't spend a whole lot of time with this. Just have to kind of remember how it's done. Yes. Well, any idea how long it takes? Well, once mom and dad get together and the ova meets the sperm and you get fertilization, how long does it take before you have a beating heart? Anybody know? Nope. Not 9 months. When can you start determining a heartbeat in a fetus? Sorry? Yeah, 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. So think about that. You know, we talk about being careful with females with smoking and drinking and those sorts of things and getting pregnant. How often, ladies, do you usually figure out you're pregnant? Yes, right? You start to miss your first period. And at 4 weeks, you now have a viable nervous system and cardiovascular system. That's how quickly cells divide. Yes. Okay. So it can go pretty quickly. It really can. And again, you do have increased rates or decreased rates depending on the tissues you're talking about. As I said, epithelial tissue has a very high turnover, where other cells are a little bit slower in terms of healing. If you have damage to a tendon, for example, which has very poor blood supply, cellular healing is quite slow in that tissue, for example. It just really depends on oxygen availability and all those sorts of things. But like I said, when we're looking at fertilization of ovum sperm to create a fetus, it's pretty darn quick. Well, think about how big a baby from absolutely nothing to a 8-pound child, newborn coming out of mom in 9 months. That's pretty quick. I think of cows and horses. I mean, you got an animal that can come out and start running around, right? It's crazy. All right, so that was mitosis. So, sort of alluded to it a couple times there. What about sex cells? It's like that George Michael song, eh? What about sex, baby? Nobody here remembers that song, do they? Okay, so we have normal cells. We talked about how they divide. When you create two cells, they have completely viable genetic material in order to function. But what happens with sex cells? Now we're talking gametes here. So we're talking sperm and we're talking ovum. So of course we are sexual beings. So we decided that sexual reproduction for humans, that's what worked for us. Are there asexual species out there? Yes, they are able to reproduce without the use of sex. Right, and there's many different ways to do it. So for whatever reason, evolutionarily, we decided that sex was the way for mammals, and I'd say it was probably a pretty good idea because we're kind of overpopulating the earth, and look at we're gone nuts with it. So it seems to be the way to go. So the thing we have to remember with sexual reproduction, or even asexual reproduction, is the flourishing of the species. Now, the one thing we do want to do is we always want to create unique individuals in development. So whether or not that's a flower or a human or a cow or a pig or a horse, they may look like one. A pig has four legs and has that colored skin and a little curly tail and so forth. Us as human beings, we have two arms, two hands, two feet, and so forth, and we look like a human being, Homo sapien. Right? We have to have that, but are we all the same? In some ways we are. We all have a heart and two lungs and stomach and all sorts of things, but we're also uniquely different. We're one-offs, right? We don't clone as human beings. Anybody know what cloning is? What is cloning compared to the creation of a new human being? Same thing in every possible way, right? So we're going to learn that in meiosis, we actually have deliberate interchange of genetic material such that they're uniquely a one-off. They do carry traits from both mom and dad. We all carry traits from mom and dad, hence the reason why we have similar looks possibly or similar stature or so forth, but we're still slightly different from both mom and dad. And then on top of that, we have recessive genes. And these are little things that kind of sneak around quietly, and then all of a sudden you're in grade, 10, and here you are, you've got carrot red hair. Yes, I was an actual redhead, right? And that was a recessive gene that hadn't been in my mom's side of the family for five generations. And they just hang around, and every once in a while, it pops up and somebody gets red hair. So we have these little things that kind of hide and sneak around too. So in sexual reproduction, each new organism is the result of the union of two different gametes, in our case, sperm and ovum. Somatic cells through mitosis gives us cells with the appropriate number of chromosomes. So with appropriate number of chromosomes, we couldn't get sexual reproduction if we brought two fully functional cells together. In other words, what we're trying to do is, when a sperm and an ovum come together, it's about creating a viable single cell that has a full complement of 23 pairs of DNA, or chromosomes, right? So that means that both the ovum and the sperm have half a viable amount of chromosomes, so that when the two come together, we now create the very first cell of an individual that has a full complement of 23 pairs of chromosomes. Some from mom and some from dad. Uniquely becomes this new person. Meiosis produces gametes with half the number of chromosomes. They are known as haploid cells. So when they have the full complement of chromosomes, which you just saw in mitosis, that is known as a diploid cell. Di meaning two of the same. When we create sex cells, because they have half the complement, they're called haploid cells. So we take, how many cells did we create in mitosis? We had one cell that created two cells. In meiosis, we have one cell that creates four cells, each one with half the complement. So we initially create a cell with a full complement, and then we don't get duplication of genetic material, and it divides, and we end up with two cells with half a complement, right? Fertilization restores the full complement of chromosomes. So this is the type of cellular division that occurs in developing sex cells. So when we think about what's happening, females are creating ovum all the time. And again, I'm going to disclose, I'm going to just throw out there that when I understand now that we look at genders being relatively fluid in our society, what constitutes a man, what constitutes a woman. I said to you guys before, from a scientific perspective, from now, when I talk about sex cells and gender, I'm only talking about chromosomes, so X, Y, X, X. So when we're discussing this, and there can be variations of X, Y, and X, X. You can have one or different ones. So I think we're going to find in the future that there's going to be more variations of those sex chromosomes in individuals compared to what we thought as far as that goes. But for now, we're just talking sort of the traditional sense. So in the female, this is known as oogenesis. So you create four ovum once a month. How many do you actually ovulate? One. What happens to the other three? They get eaten by the one. Yes, for fuel. Males, you only need one. So this is interesting. It's evolution. So females create one egg. Okay? Males, evolutionarily, we know that for me to impregnate an ovum, it's kind of hard to get in there and get at the ovum. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I just mean it's kind of hard to get there. So what do? We shoot with a machine gun. So rather than having one sperm, what do? We have millions of sperm because we're just trying to get as many cells in there as possible. Did you guys know that there's kamikaze sperm? kamikaze sperm. So there are sperm that deliberately go ahead and die on purpose because the female environment is too acidic for sperm to survive. Right? So your environment inside is actually sperm don't survive well in there. So kamikaze sperm go out first and die on purpose, thus making the environment more alkaline in nature so that sperm can survive and get up high enough to get at the ovum. It's kind of like this escalating war between the sexes that we don't even realize sort of microscopically. And so we have to produce lots of sperm. By the way, gentlemen, you all know that if you compare yourself to your great-grandfather, your sperm's down about 40%. So males, handmaid tale, it's kind of a reverse handmaid tale. Males' fertility has been increasingly diminishing over generations. And the fear is, and it all has to do with environmental chemicals, phthalates, estrogen-mimicking chemicals, all those sorts of things. Male sperm counts are getting dangerously low. And it's not good. Anyways, take a break. I'll see you guys. See you at the top of the hour at 5 after. Okay, so let's continue on this theme of meiosis. I said we're looking at four cells with half genetic complement, and they are known as haploid cells. So we can see here where we had mitosis, which was one set of steps of prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. We can see here in the diagram that in meiosis, there's two steps. There's a meiosis one and a meiosis two, because we have to take the two cells that, shall we say, have a full complement of DNA, and we have to divide them yet again to get a half amount, okay? So that's the distinct difference. There's a number of other differences as well. So the resulting cells from spermatogenesis or oogenesis, of course, in oogenesis, it's the female, it's the ovum. In spermatogenesis, just as the name kind of suggests, it's the male that produces four sperm for every meiosis division. The basic definition for meiosis one is we create one diploid cell that produces four haploids. So each one diploid cell gets divided again and again into four haploid cells. So in diploid division, in mitotic division, we had one cell that created one cell, right? So meiotic process involves two nuclear divisions. We have the reduction division and the equatorial division, and we'll explain more about those in a moment. So, in meiosis one, we have a cell that goes still through all the steps of interphase with G1, S, and G2. There's still four phases in meiosis one. It's prophase one, metaphase one, anaphase one, and telophase one. We have a diploid cell to begin with, which means we have one cell that has a full complement of genetic material, 23 pairs, 22 in one sex pair. Okay, so we all start out with that. Okay, and by the way, oogenesis takes place where, ladies? Where do you produce ovum? Ovaries. And in males, spermatogenesis occurs in the testes is correct. Okay, you have something above the testicle where they mature. So we create immature sperm in the testes, and then we have another part that we have it in. But you'll learn that next semester in the reproduction lectures. We do not have meiosis until chromosomal replication ends. So with prophase one, normal. Nuclear envelope, nucleolus disappears, mitotic spindle forms. No different than what we saw in mitosis. So we had this genetic material be created, right? We had chromatin condensed into chromosomes, nuclear envelope disappears, nucleolus disappears. Now, in this case, it takes a considerable amount of time. So two events take place that are different as compared to mitosis. The first is the two sister chromatids of each pair, the homologous chromosomes pair off, which forms a tetrad. So what we see here in the diagram is that we have on the left sister chromatids. Sister chromatids means that if we go back to mitosis, we had chromatins condensed in the chromosomes, and then it replicated, right? So that we had what looked like an X, so we had a chromosome, the original one on one side, and the reproduction or duplication on the other side connected at the centromere, right? Remember that? Okay, so that's what this is on the left. These sister chromatids are kind of lining up. Then we have parts of the chromosome that cross over. So we have a crossover that's happening between the non-sister chromatids, and then they switch off. So the genetic material is slightly different. So we can see where all of a sudden, where we had BAG in capital BAG, we now have two new ones in the case of the blue one, where it said BAG, BAG. Now we have BAG in capitals, BA in lowercase, and capital G. So that means that we now have a unique chromosome that's never existed before because of this genetic recombination. So we say the two sister chromatids of each pair of the homologous chromosomes pair off, which form a tetrad. Parts of the chromatids of two homologous chromosomes may be exchanged with each other, which is known as genetic crossover. In other words, we have an exchange of chromatid segments. This is considered to be a genetic recombination. This is a brand new formation of genes, which means that when the individual is going to be created, because this is happening whether it's oogenesis or spermatogenesis, that means that these sex cells have recombined genetic material in them, which means that when they get together, because we have these recombinations, we get two half complements of recombinations that come together, we now truly get a uniquely recombined genetic individual. It still has influential genetic material that results in, you know, certain features of the family have, size of nose, color of hair, so forth, those sorts of things. But they are uniquely different. This genetic crossover allows for four genetically different chromatids within the two homologous double chromatid chromosomes. Okay? So you get four rather than two. So that means, you know, once they get split off into these four different haploid cells, there's similarities, but all four are different. So in the case of sperm, for example, depends on which sperm gets together with the ovum. If it's this sperm with the ovum, it could be result in these kind of genetic things. If it's that sperm in the ovum, it could be slightly different again and so forth. This is why there's similarities but differences, okay? So you get genetic variations among humans. It's what's kept us alive. We want genetic variations. And if you think about the possibility of genetic crossover, it does suggest evolution. How did we have the variations that we have? Right? How are we different than our ancient ancestors compared to where we are now? What kind of things through genetic recombination did we gain or get rid of as time went on? Right? That's how it kind of happens. At the end of meiosis one, each cell has 23 chromosomes rather than 46 with mitosis. From one cell that is diploid, again, you produce four cells that are genetically different. So we can see here, we had prophase one, we had the dissolving of the nuclear membrane, we have the movement of the centrioles to become mitotic spindles, we have duplication of genetic material here to form chromosomes from chromatin. We then have these all line up, and we can see they've crossed over. So where we had red and red, we now have red and blue. So in mitosis, if we wanted to call chromosomes red and blue and green and yellow, the reds would line up, the blues would line up, the greens would line up, the yellows would line up, and so forth. In meiosis, you get a red and green, blue and purple, blue and green, and they're slightly different. And then to really change things up, you can get genetic recombination. So not only do you have this variation in chromosomes, meaning that if we look, for example, just at this one here, if this cell were to divide just as it is right now,
it would be slightly different on either side because red's gone with blue and blue's gone with red. So therefore, when they get pulled apart, the cells are going to be slightly different. Yes? Do you see that? So instead of red and red, green and green, blue and blue, and so forth, so they're all exactly the same, you now get a difference there. And then you cross over the ends, you get recombination. So now you've got, in this case here, you can see blue with a tip of red, and red with a tip of blue, and so forth. Everything is slightly different. So you're getting recombinations, which results in all this diversity that we can have in terms of what makes us so much different from each other. So in meiosis one, the double chromatids don't pull apart, but instead 23 go to one pole while 23 go to the other. So where they get pulled apart are the centromeres, ripped apart, so you had exactly the same one go either side, you actually get the whole double, two of them get pulled. So now you have further difference in genetic material between them. Meiosis two is the formation of the four haploid cells from two haploids. So in meiosis one, we took a diploid cell and we created two haploids. So we had doubling of genetic material, but rather than being split apart at the centromeres, the whole unit's pulled apart. So we've had them line up differently. We've had them cross over genetic material, and instead of being pulled apart, these two get pulled to the right, these two get pulled over to the left, further changing things, right? So you get 23 and 23. So you get two haploid cells, which is half the complex. Where did I say they doubled up? I think I may have, didn't I? Right, so it's 23 and 23, now 46 and 46. So I may say they doubled up, which would have resulted in 46 and 46. But actually, they don't double up, so you end up with 23, 23. So you're already in half, right? Okay, so the fact that you've got this 23 and 23, you now have two haploid cells. Only a single set. So they're not viable from the perspective of the individual that they've come from, right? They started as a diploid cell that had 23 pair. Now we have 23 singles in each cell, right? Okay, so we can see they don't pull apart, but instead 23 go one, 23 go the other, so now we have two haploids. In meiosis two, we create four haploid cells from two haploid cells. In meiosis one, we created two haploid cells from one diploid cell. So in meiosis one, we created two haploid cells from one diploid. In meiosis two, we take two haploid cells and create two haploid cells. So in mitosis, one cell with full complement of DNA to two cells with half complement of DNA. And in meiosis two, we have two cells of half complement of chromosomal material, and we create four cells of half chromosomal material. How do we do that? There's also four phases here, prophase, anaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. The 23 chromatids from meiosis one duplicate. Okay? So we're duplicating only half a set of chromosomal material. Have I lost you all yet? So we went from one diploid to a haploid. And now that haploid cell is going to go through all the steps of division, which includes genetic duplication. But because we don't have a full set, we've only created two half sets. So that means that when the cell divides again, we're going to have the half sets pulled on either side. And because we have two haploids, we're going to end up with four haploids. So the 23 chromatids from meiosis one duplicate through the S phase, and then we have all the same steps, and at the end we get four cells that have half the complement. So we can see here, right, here's our division into two haploid cells. And now in meiosis two, we're going to duplicate the genetic material, and they're going to divide again to create four, all four cells having half genetic material with recombinations. So therefore, the potential is for a completely unique individual that's never existed before. Any questions? Okay. In the male, this process is called spermatogonia. Is a diploid cell which produces four sperm cells. So spermatogonia is the formation of the four sperm haploid cells. In females, oogonia is a diploid cell which produces four ovum, and only one cell is considered viable, and the other are known as polar bodies, which the viable ovum eats and takes energy from as it moves down through ovulation. Occasionally, though, you might get two, but not very often. Pretty much they're destroyed. So, and do you have a set number of ovum, ladies? Okay. So we can see it here, working all the way through. Here we've got diploid cell. We've got these genetic recombinations here, right? It hasn't duplicated, divided to both sides. You can see here crossing over, get pulled apart. And then we have two haploid cells that we do have duplication of genetic material, but it's only half a set, which gives us four cells of half a complement of genetic material. In summary, meiosis one starts with a diploid and ends with two cells, each with the haploid number of chromosomes. In meiosis two, the two haploid cells divide. No DNA replication ends with four haploid gametes that are genetically different from the original diploid cell. It's believed that this diversity and these genetic alterations help prevent mutations from moving forward in the species. And I believe it also it accounts for the possibility of evolutionary changes as we move through time. Okay? Guess what? We're done with cells. Now we're into fun stuff. We have this, and then we'll start on the integumentary system next week. So, first we have to understand healing and inflammation. This is an integral part to some of the pathologies you're going to take and understanding what happens when we're looking at tissues that get destroyed or how healing takes place in the human body when there's damage and so on and so forth. So, what is inflammation? Oh, crap, I didn't do that, did I? Sorry. I meant to do it, but we started on the other ones and I forgot all about it. Everybody has it, yes? Good. What is going on here? God, there it is. I don't understand why it defaults to this. Come on. There we go. Okay. So, what is inflammation? You've all heard the term before, but what is it? Okay. All right. What else? Anybody? What do you think about inflammation? Swelling, okay, fluid buildup, heat. Is it bad? Sometimes. No, necessarily. So it does get a bad rap when we think of tendonitises and bursitises and those sorts of things. We think, oh my goodness, you know, those are detrimental. They limit movement and so on and so forth. It is, in fact, important. Without inflammation, you don't get healing. You must have inflammation for healing. So inflammation is integral, but it can be a bit nasty at times. So it is a non-specific defense response of the body to tissue damage. So any kind of tissue damage can result in an inflammatory reaction. So pathogens can cause inflammation. Abrasions can cause inflammation, chemical irritants, distortion or disturbance of cells, extreme temperatures, both hot and cold. In other words, it's an attempt to dispose of microbes, toxins, or foreign materials at the site of injury. So inflammation is integral. We need it. It's vital. It helps clean up areas of damage. It helps take away dead cells and so forth. Can it get out of control? Yes, it can. Can it get stuck in the body and be in a chronic state? Yes, it can. So it's got its good points, and as I said, we can't have healing without it. So it is an attempt to dispose of these things. It also helps things from leaving a damaged site, for example, to get through the tissues. It also prepares the site for tissue repair to restore homeostasis. Because at the end of the day, we have to be able to repair whatever's damaged. Gold standard to recognize inflammation. You've probably already done this in theory class, yes? No? Okay. Prish. First is pain. So you get pain in the area due to release of chemicals. We're going to discover that chemicals get released which make you more sensitive to pain. Redness. You get hyperemia. So you get blood that's coming to the area. Part of the inflammatory response is to deliberately bring blood to the injured site, which of course brings oxygen and nutrients for cells to manage the metabolism. It also brings healing things to the site and so forth. So blood, because it's coming to the area, starts to make it look red. Immobility. The body does naturally immobilize an area of damage. Sometimes you'll hear it in rehab medicine called splinting. So if someone has back pain, they get spasms in the back. And what that is the body's attempt to splint the area to prevent it from moving because the body knows it's hurting and it kind of tries to prevent the patient from moving in a direction that could elicit the pain. So you get mobility, so you don't get function in the area. Swelling. You do get swelling. There is a deliberateness in changing cell membranes or shall we say vessel membranes in the cardiovascular system to make capillaries very leaky, which brings fluids into the area, which does provide some mobility reduction. At the same time, we want these leaky vessels because other things need to come out of the vessel in order to help in the healing process. And the last is heat. Of course, blood internally in the body is much hotter than what you think of at that 98.6 temperature. It's actually much warmer, so this is why you get heat to the area. So obviously, this is something you're looking for the classic signs. If a patient comes to you, quite often, one of the things you look for is heat. Has anybody talked to you about how you touch for heat in the body? Right? So use the back of the hand, not the front of the hand. Right? Okay, so because it's more sensitive to that temperature change. And so quite often you'll have a painful area and you'll touch the patient on both sides in the same area. The unaffected side will be quite cool, the affected side might be quite hot, which may indicate that there's inflammation going on deep in there somewhere from damage or something else. This results in the same response when there's damage, whether that's from a cut, a burn, radiation such as sunburn, or a bacterial viral invasion. It doesn't matter what it is, if it does damage to tissue, you get an inflammatory response, no matter what that is. In fact, you're going to learn some techniques in the coming semesters that you're trying to elicit an inflammatory response to help you in the healing process. Three basic steps to the inflammatory area. So the first is if we have a very minor wound of the skin. So, in the skin, we have the epidermis, which is the most superficial layer, and then we have the dermis of the skin, which is just deep to the epidermis. Okay? So when we talk about an epidermal wound healing, we're talking about damage to tissue that just gets down to the dermal area. So, the upper layer of the skin's been damaged, but you don't have damage into the deeper skin itself. Right? Think of, when you stick a the guy who used to in elementary school would stick a pin in their hand and run it all the way through and there'd be no pain or bleeding or anything. That pin was going through the epidermis, not into the dermis. It's the dermis that has blood supply and nerve supply and all those sorts of things. So think of just how superficial that is. So when you have this kind of wound, you only have slight damage to the superficial epidermal cells, these upper cells. You could have this could be an abrasion like road rash or something like that that hasn't done much damage, or minor burns. So what happens is in the epidermis you do have these cells, these stem cells that are said to be undifferentiated. In other words, they don't know what they want to be yet. So they can become an epidermal cell. So what they'll do is they'll migrate around the wound. They'll break contact with what's called the basement membrane, which we'll learn at some point. Well, you guys talked, I keep forgetting, you guys did the self work on tissues. So the basement membrane, you all know what that is now, don't you? All right? It's that sort of underlying glue that holds everything together that they all attach to, right? So what we're saying here is that, you know, they break contact with the basal membrane and they move into the wound site. When the cells then enlarge and they start to create sheets migrating towards the center of the small damage, sort of covering it over like a, you know, laying down a sheet of saran wrap type of thing. When these cells encounter each other, so when they're, as they're coming across and they touch, this pure touch inhibits any further movements. So we say it's contact inhibition. So they migrate across the wound until they touch each other, and then that migration stops. And now the wound has been kind of covered over. As the migration is occurring, we have something called epidermal growth factor, which is a hormone, and this stimulates basal cells to divide. We're going to learn if these blocks represent the epidermis, okay? This is the dermal layer here is white. The epidermis represents these blocks with, of course, the skin that you can see and touch being at the top of the gray blocks, okay? So we have layers of cells that work their way up. And we're going to learn when we talk about the integumentary system that the cells down here near the basement membrane, which is down here, the dermal layer, these guys are alive. These cells are alive. And as they move up, they start to get impregnated with a protein called keratin, right, which provides strength and so forth to the skin cells. As they move up, they get more and more keratinized until eventually they get to the top and they're dead. So they're nothing more than a dead cell membrane full of keratin. There's no organelles or anything in there. And that's what, you know, comes off skin. We're sloughing them off all the time. So down here, these very low cells that are alive, this is called the basilar layer or the basal layer. So these cells mature and divide, and as they divide, they migrate upward. So as you're sloughing off cells on the top, you have these basal cells that are continuing producing new cells at the bottom. So we can say that the epidermis basically fills up from the bottom up. You have cells always dividing up to the top. So we say, as this migration is occurring, a hormone called epidermal growth factor stimulates these basal cells at the bottom to divide and replace those cells that have moved into the wound. And these new basal cell epidermal cells divide to build a new strata, which results in thickening of the new epidermis. And when you have a epidermal wound, it doesn't scar. So this is where, you know, you've had a wound on the skin that's so shallow that when it heals, you wouldn't even know anything happens. It just like it did before it was injured. Okay? So that's said and done. You generally don't get an inflammatory response with an epidural wound heal. Right? It just kind of takes care of itself with this migration and so forth. Now we have to talk about deep wound healing. So what happens when we get down into deeper structures here? The body recognizes that there's tissue damage or cell damage, and it starts this whole inflammatory response. First, you get vasodilation and increased permeability of blood vessels. When we look at a blood vessel that's, say, so big around, if we say that there's vasodilation, that blood vessel gets larger in diameter, okay? So we're saying that all the capillaries that are in the wound area, they all become increased in diameter, thus bringing more blood to the area. The tissue that makes up the vessel itself, there are three layers to it. There's an outer layer, an inner layer, and an inner layer. Those layers become leaky. They become more permeable, meaning that they allow more blood through, or they are leaky. So we say the permeability of the capillaries increases, and this allows normally retained substances to leak out. So in your bloodstream, you've got platelets, white blood cells, those sorts of things, and they're going to stay in the blood vessels until you have injury, and then this permeability changes, and these cells that are integral to fighting an infection or cleaning up a wound site, they're now able to kind of squeeze out through the capillaries and get into the wound area and then perform their tasks, which we'll talk about. This change in permeability allows antibodies, immune proteins, and clotting factors to enter the injured area. And also, the blood flow allows for the removal of toxins and dead cells, because you can have inflammation and tissue damage if you have a viral infection. So, of course, the immune system has to come in and kill that virus if it can, in order for it not to take over the body and possibly kill the host. So we can see here, we have damaged cells, right? We get these signals that get released and starts this whole process.
You can see that the vessel's gotten wider in diameter. The tissue that makes up the vessel becomes more permeable. We can see these cells now able to squeeze out and get into the wound site to help with the infection. So in this first stage of this vasodilation and this increased permeability, two particular chemicals get involved. The first are called histamines, right? So histamines are mast cells and connective tissue, basophils, and platelets. These guys all release histamine, and histamine causes vasodilation and increased permeability, okay? Think of antihistamines you take when you have allergic reaction. What's going on inside your nose? You have a runny nose, permeability is changing, and you're leaking out mucus and all things, right? The other thing that gets released are called kinins. These are peptides that are in blood from inactive precursors, kininogens. This also produces vasodilation and increased it induces vasodilation and increases it, but it also, some kinins, such as bradykinin, actually makes tissues more sensitive to pain. Doesn't want you poking on there anymore. You know how you give yourself a cut and the next day you get up and it's a little red around the edges and you barely touch the wound site because it's really sensitive to pain? That's because of kinins. So it increases tissue sensitivity, in other words, makes it more painful. It also acts as an agent to stimulate the movement of phagocytes into the area. Phagocytes are cells that eat. Okay? Their whole job is to go in and eat anything that's in there that's invading, any viral cells, those sorts of things, try to kill them off and get rid of them. The third are called prostaglandins. These are chemicals that are released when cells are damaged. They intensify histamine and kinins. So prostaglandins make these much more powerful, so you get even more vasodilation and more increased for permeability, more sensitivity to pain, and so forth. Leukotrienes are produced by basophils and mast cells. They also increase permeability. They also help phagocytes, big eaters, to stick to the pathogens to eat them. The chemical also attracts phagocytes to the area of damage. So it's kind of a call out to everybody, come to this damaged area. We have some work to do. And some leukotrienes, they're within that, they get sort of things moving and going. Complement system is a whole system. It also stimulates histamine release. It attracts neutrophils, which are another type of white blood cell, promotes phagocytosis, and some of these complements can destroy bacteria. So we can see here, we've got histamine and prostaglandins released, and then we get capillary dilation, increased permeability, platelets start to begin, and we start to get clotting that's beginning in the area. We end up, it becomes so permeable, we get phagocytes and leukocytes enter the region and so forth. Obviously, pain is a prime symptom of inflammation. So, you know, if somebody comes to you with pain, you touch the area, it's warm, it's not to be surprised with. So what happens is, when you have damaged the tissue, you've likely damaged neurons, because, you know, the branches of them are spread throughout, but you also have toxic chemicals which are released by microbes, and that can further stimulate pain. And then, of course, this bradykinin and these kinins further stimulate these nerve endings to make them even more sensitive to pain. Right? It wants you to become aware that something's painful. You'll use it less. You'll clean it. You won't touch it as much and so forth. Swelling is very interesting because swelling, stretched tissue, is very sensitive to pain. So quite often, people here have badly sprained their ankles. That swelling, that ankle that gets up the size of a softball, the tissue that's stretched in that swelling, it's also now providing extra pain to that area because tissue doesn't like to be really stretched. It's quite sensitive to pain. So that, and even if it's in the joint and the joint capsule stretching along with it, that's even worse. The most sensitive tissue in your body is the skin on the bone, and sometimes the capsule itself as well can be quite sensitive to pain. Along with the release of previous materials from the increased permeability of the capillaries, we also see clotting factors entering the area as well. So we've had increased permeability, we've had vasodilation, we're starting to see things moving into the area. Now we can move into stage two, which is the movement of phagocytes, which are a particular type of white blood cell, into the area to start cleaning up the site, shall we say.
So within an hour after the inflammatory process starts, phagocytes begin to appear. Large amounts of blood begin to accumulate. Neutrophils begin to stick to the inner surface of the inner lining of the blood vessels. These neutrophils, again, they're a type of white blood cell, so they're involved in the immune response. They squeeze through the wall of the blood vessel to reach the damaged area. The neutrophils that are kind of squeezing through this more permeable blood vessel, this is known as emigration, and this depends on what's called chemotaxis. I mean, chemically induced cellular movement is what chemotaxis means. Okay, so the release of these chemicals we previously talked about stimulates these cells to kind of squeeze through and get out into the area, to move into the area. And then neutrophils use phagocytosis to destroy any invaders. We get a steady stream of neutrophils when we have the release of white blood cells from bone marrow, and this is known as leukocytosis. So many of you here may have had not feeling well. Maybe you thought you had something going on. The doctor takes your blood and they measure your white blood cell count and say, oh, you have an infection somewhere because your white blood cell count is up. Yes, you've heard that before. That's because if there is something going on that solicited an immune response and you've had an increased production of white blood cells. So it's one of the things that a physician can look at with a blood sample and see an increase in white blood cells will denote that there's an infection or an inflammatory reaction to something going on in the body. So we can see here the leukocytes in the blood respond to chemical attractants released by pathogens and chemical signals from the nearby cells. So we have the neutrophil here, all these white blood cells, eosinophil, monocyte, and neutrophils. So they're stimulated to come to the area of damage. We can see the capillary and the epithelial cells, right? They're going to start getting spaces between them, which makes the capillary kind of leaky. Then we see, because of the chemicals, leukocytes start to squeeze out. Leukocytes are white blood cells. White leuko is white. Now, whether it's an eosinophil, monocyte, or neutrophil, they start to squeeze through these openings to get in the area where there's been damaged. Within the damaged tissue, the monocytes differentiate into macrophages, big eaters, and they phagocytize the pathogen. So they go in and they start to try to eat the pathogens. Eosinophils can release cytotoxic chemicals, which will kill the invading bacteria. Because even if you have a wound, like a cut, you know, potential for a bacterial invasion is quite high, and they'll go in and try to eat up those sorts of things. As the inflammatory response continues, the monocytes follow the neutrophils as they're quickly dying off. Monocytes become wandering macrophages, which are a bit more effective than phagocytes and phagocytosis. So these big eaters start coming in and they start eating these invaders. Now, as this is occurring, the macrophages, they start to die off because they're fighting the fight, they're eating these bacteria, and they start to die and more are coming in behind. Think of it as like a battle that's occurring, right? The body's sending in an army, you've got these invaders through the wound, and this is ongoing. As these macrophages die, we start to see pockets of dead macrophages, which we know as pus. Okay? So when you're seeing pus in a wound, that represents that the macrophages are battling whatever's going on, and that is basically an accumulation of dead macrophages and some of the invasion bacteria or so forth that's infecting it. Now, you can see all the classic signs of inflammation are here, right? You've got redness, swelling. That's a pretty sore-looking thumb to me. I think that's pretty sore. I heard something one day on a documentary. I didn't know that. Pus actually tastes sweet. And at times during the Second World War, when people were in concentration camps and were starving, they would take individuals and they would suck their pus to try to get some sort of nutrient out of it. So, what's homeostasis, right? Homeostasis is maintaining balance in tissues and working properly. The inflammatory response is, in fact, actually trying to maintain homeostasis in damaged tissue. So, as part of homeostasis, any damage to tissues must be repaired to ensure integrity from a protective to a functional return to perspective. So if I'm going to do damage to tissue, I want to be able to, as the body, I want to fix the damaged area, but I would really like to fix the damaged area to be as functional as it was before it was damaged.
Makes sense, right? So, repair is the replacement of worn out, damaged, or dead cells. New cells can originate by cell division from the following. Cells can either repair the area from connective tissue, these are known as stromal cells or the stroma, or cells that constitute the functioning part of the tissue or organ are known as parenchymal or parenchyma cells. So if we have a wound, if it's healed via stromal cells, you get scarring. You don't get a perfect repair. The wound is fixed, but the cells that are in the wound site are no longer skin cells or stomach cells or whatever they may be. They're connective tissue scar. If the wound is repaired by stromal cells, then if it was skin, cells that repaired are skin cells. If it was a stomach cell, the cells that repair are stomach cells, and it returns back to normal function. This is why you get stitched. If you have a significant enough cut, they have to stitch. By bringing the wound ends together, you're more likely to get stromal repair, which means you get less scarring and the tissue functions properly. If you have a really bad wound that's quite wide or large with a lot of damage, unfortunately, you don't get a lot of stromal innervation. You get a lot of parenchyma cells go back to normal. If you've got a large wound, it's the stromal cells that will go in, invade with connective tissue, and you get the scar. So stromal cells are scarring, and parenchymal cells represent the return to the tissue that was injured in the first place. You really want to remember that. Okay? You really want to remember that. So, each of the four tissues have different capacity for regeneration of parenchymal cells. Remember, the four tissues are what? Epithelial, connective, muscle, and nervous. Okay? Connective, epithelial, muscle, and nervous. Each of those four types of tissue have the capacity for regeneration, some better than others. So epithelial tissue has a high capacity for regeneration due to the nature of the sloughing off. So usually epithelial damage heals quite nicely. You don't get much of a scar, maybe a small one. Some connective tissue have a continuous capacity for renewal, such as bone. So bone heals quite nicely. But cartilage and tendons have very poor blood supply. They don't heal well at all. This is why if you get a tendonitis, it's very difficult to repair because their blood supply is so poor. Okay? Muscular tissue has a poor capacity for regeneration as they're slow to divide. And cardiac cells, for example, cardiac muscle cells, don't even go under mitosis to form new cells. So if you have a heart attack, for example, and you have death to heart tissue because of a heart attack, the area where there was death due to the heart attack, that just becomes a big scar and never ever contracts again. Just becomes a useless part of the heart that doesn't do anything. You can't get good regeneration in the heart. And then nerve tissue is the poorest capacity for regeneration as they normally do not go through mitosis. This is why if you have severe nerve damage, it doesn't come back. It doesn't come back. There are certain situations where it does come back, but it doesn't. So I just want to finish this as it relates to stromal and parenchymal cells. The restoration of an injured tissue or organ to normal structure and function depends on whether parenchymal cells are active in the repair process. For a near-perfect reconstruction to occur, parenchymal cells must do the fix. Okay? Parenchymal cells equals normal function. If fibroblasts of the stroma are involved, the repair will be connective tissue. Parenchymal cells equals a return to normal functioning cells. Stromal cells equals connective tissue, and these fibroblasts that go into the wound site, they synthesize collagen that aggregates together. It forms a scar, and that scar is known as fibrosis. Anybody here have friends who have really torturous, twisted scar somewhere in their body? Like real significant? Anybody here, unfortunately, have a friend who's got a bad burn or something like that, and you see the
knotting, twisting look of the skin. That's because there was so much tissue damage done, it's been completely replaced by fibrosis and through this connective tissue of these stromal cells, and you, it tightens in and it can't function properly. It's quite a significant damage. Okay? Do you have a question? Okay. So tissue will not have the same properties as the original tissue as it's replacing, which will result in impaired function. So we can see here on the bottom, this is a parenchymal type of heel here. We can see what looks like relatively normal repair here. The skin will have nice turgor. It'll be able to stretch and twist and turn. It won't affect the individual's range of motion, those sorts of things. Whereas we can see here, this was, it looks like a surgical site to me, or a significantly large wound. We can see almost where the stitches or the staples were put down. This is a fairly fresh wound. And we can see that this is not parenchymal tissue. This is stromal connective tissue. This is a scar. And that will continue to harden and thicken as time goes on. Same thing here. This is a very large wound. This is all connective tissue. And what happens in fibrosis, it twists, turns, and tightens, and that tissue won't act the same any longer. It becomes restricted. It doesn't function the same, hasn't got the same flexibility or so forth of the tissue that it's replacing. Okay, so we'll leave it at that, and we'll come back and finish this off, and we will be starting the integumentary system next week, which is the skin system, and then we'll be on systems for the rest of the time here. We're done with all the sciencey stuff, if you want to call it that. Okay, see you guys on Wednesday. Woo-hoo.